Hello, and welcome to Sherlock, from Adler to Amberley. An attempt to analyse all 56 of the Sherlock Holmes short stories by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, in order. Starting with the first story, A Scandal in Bohemia, featuring the celebrated adventuress Irene Adler, and finishing with the final story of the casebook of Sherlock Holmes, The Retired Colourman, where Holmes and Watson accept the case from Mr. Josiah Amberley. Hence, from Adler to Amberley. My name is Carl Kopak, and I'll be presenting this irregular series along with a special guest as we attempt to assess the value of each tale of the canon. A recap of The Adventure of the Three Students by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. We're not in 221B Baker Street this time. We're in a university town. We don't know which university town because Conan Doyle doesn't tell us. And it's been the subject of many debates over the years. Some people think it's Cambridge, some people think it's Oxford, because of, you know, the Glorious Scott as well. So this is a long-standing issue. But anyway, Holmes and Watson are in their rooms because Holmes has, they've come to this university town so Holmes can do some research on early English charters. What a riveting subject that must be. They're there at night when Mr. Hilton Soames turns up. He is the lecturer at St. Luke's College. Again, we don't know where that is. And he's basically in charge of an exam there for the Fortescue Award, or the Fortescue Prize. It's a very, very important exam. A lot of cash behind it. Anyway, Soames says he's very, very, he's all over the place. His head is absolutely gone. Soames says that he's been reviewing the exam papers when he's had to leave his room for an hour or so because he's had tea with a friend. This is a university town, they do that sort of thing. When he came back, he saw that as his sort of number two, really, a man called Bannister had gone into the room but left his key in the lock, which means anyone can walk into the room and find those exam papers. And of course, that's exactly what's happened. Bannister is all over, he too is all over the place, and he collapses into a chair, a fair distance away from the front door, but says he hasn't moved the papers. So someone has been in the room and examined the papers. Again, this isn't a murder mystery. This is a puzzle story, this one. Soames does find some clues around the room. There's a broken pencil lead, there's some shavings, and there's a weird sort of clay doughy mass thing in a little triangle. So someone's been in there and left these there, and we don't know what they are. There's also a scratch on his desk in the sort of the velvet sort of cushion type area of his desk, and he can't work out what that is. There are three candidates to this. There's a man called Gilchrist, who's a very happy-go-lucky athletic bloke. He's one of the options. The other one is a man called Dalet Ras, who's a methodical sort of bloke, quite steady. Sadly, only just known as the Indian a lot of time in this story, which I don't like. Might get onto that. Quite a rude man upstairs called Miles McLaren, who's sort of a big gambler and, you know, a shocking sort of, a bit rude, basically. He's a gambler. Speaking of gamblers, in fact, Gilchrist's dad, we discuss later on, is Jabez Gilchrist, who lost all his money while gambling. So gambling seems to be a bit of a theme here. I bet Watson loves that. Anyway, Holmes and Watson go along, and they have a look at, you know, see what the options are. Holmes deduces immediately that the man took the papers from one position, carried them over to the window where he copied them, not only because of the light maybe, but because might be able to see Soames return across the courtyard. Soames doesn't come back that way. I've just realised we've got Soames and Holmes, a bit inelegant. He came back through a side door. Holmes has a look at the sort of doughy mass thing and tells thinks something's amiss here. And he tells Soames that the man who broke into the room probably hid in Soames' bedroom. And they go in there and look behind the curtain, and yes, there's another little doughy mass. So he was right. Soames is again thrown by this completely because he had the man in his power and didn't know it. Nor did Bannister. They best say that at this point. The next day they go back to Soames' office and they go around and speak to the students one by one. We don't actually hear those conversations, but we know that Gilchrist seems quite a jolly man. Dallas Ratt was a bit rude with them, and Miles McLaren, he wouldn't even open the door to them because he's busy. It's a big exam and he's doing lots of revision, and obviously he's clearly behind in his studies. Holmes asks Watson, which one do you think it is? Because it's definitely one of the three of them. A three-card trick, he calls it. And Watson says it's got to be the rude man, because he's rude. That seems to be the logic behind that. The cheetah is one of those three, because they knew that the papers were there. They didn't just break into the room and have a look around. They went straight to the papers. And it turns out it can only be Gilchrist, because firstly, he's like the one who's tall enough to look it through the window. The others aren't. Holmes couldn't do it. He went outside and had a look, and he's not as tall as Gilchrist, and he couldn't see the papers on the desk. And also, the blobs, which is the big thing, turn out there from a long jump pit, which means one of them is a long jumper, and that's Gilchrist. They bring Gilchrist down to the room and say, you know, it's you, isn't it? And he basically agrees straight away, yes, it was me. But then he says, Bannister, why did you give me away? And Bannister said, oh, I didn't. It's just, but, you know, I wanted to support you because I used to be your father's butler. So that's why there was a mention of Jabez Gilchrist, which seemed for no apparent reason early on. Yes, the Zoe mask comes from the spikes, left by the spikes for his running shoes. Holmes asked Bannister what it was that, why did he collapse so far away from the desk? And he said, oh, his gloves are on the chair, and that would have given him away, and he couldn't have any of that. Again, it's not a crime. So Gilchrist hasn't done anything, but it's not particularly nice. So he says, look, I'm not going to, you're right, I'm not going to sit in into the exam because I've cheated. In fact, I've decided to go away to the Rhodesian police and not sit the exam. And he goes with Holmes's good wishes. He says, you know, you're a nice man. You've made a mistake. Off you go. Let's see how high you can rise. And that's the adventure of the three students. We have two guests this time to discuss the adventure of the three students. And they're both from I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, which is one of my favourite lines from the Greek interpreter. They are Scott Monty, editor-in-chief, founder and co-host, and Bert Walder, editor and co-host. And I'm going to be brutally honest, I'm reading their biographies from their website. They are extraordinary. Scott Monty began his interest in Sherlock Holmes in his teenage years, during which he discovered his first Sherlockian society, the Men on the Tor in Connecticut. That, of course, is Tor, T-O-R, a little nod to Hound of the Baskervilles. It was his first social network. The Sherlockian societies around the Northeast were never the same after Scott descended on Boston, I can believe that, and the Baker Street Irregulars invested him in 2001. He established a web presence and an online ordering system for the Baker Street Journal later that year. His profession led him into digital communications, and as a side project, stroke laboratory, Scott founded the Baker Street blog in 2005. The blog existed as a standalone site until mid-2013. In 2007, with Bert, he added a podcast, and I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere was born. The two sites were combined in mid-2013. Do you say 2013 or 2013? I'm never sure. Anyway, to serve as the definitive site for news and information about Sherlock Holmes on the web, it still is. And because they're gluttons for punishment, he and Bert started the weekly podcast Trifles, in 2017. These are very busy men. When called upon to give toasts at the Sherlockian Scion meetings, Scott has often been known to recite them in song, his particular favourite being The Canon I Read, which is an homage to The House I Live In, originally sung by Frank Sinatra. Scott writes the Timeless and Timely newsletter and hosts the Timeless Leadership podcast. He lives in Michigan, where he is an executive coach and a public speaker, specialising in leadership and communication. Bert Walder. Bert's main library has The Count of Monte Cristo, and my God, we'll be talking about that, The Man in the Iron Mask, and The Three Musketeers. And by the time he was 13 or so, he had read through Dumas and Dickens and more. But the early joys of meeting Sherlock Holmes outlived all his literary enthusiasms. When William S. Baring Gould's The Annotated Sherlock Holmes appeared, he discovered he was not alone in his love for Baker Street. A letter to Julian Wolfe referred Bert to Steve Clarkson, mentor to the young Sherlockians. You can see also the 2013 BSJ Christmas Annual. Steve introduced Bert to Andy Page, Andy Peck and others, and brought him to his first BSI dinner. Those early dinners introduced Bert to Al Silverstein, Jan Prager, I hope I pronounced these correctly, and Chris Steinbrunner. And the Science Societies, the Cornish Horrors, the Men on the Tor, the Speckle Band of Boston, the Sons of the Copper Beaches, and more. Through the New England Science Societies, Bert met his good friend and podcaster, Scott Monty. Over the years, Bert has written more than 20 short plays for the Cornish Horrors, all Holmesian comedies. As a result, he received his BSI investiture, don't like that word, from Tom Styx, as the vaguely theatrical Third Pillar from the Left in 1988. In 2004, Bert's admiration for Kristen Morley's life and writings led him to re-establish the 3 Hours for Lunch Club, which now meets at the Players in memory of Frederick Dorr Steele and regularly elsewhere. Welcome to the podcast.
Scott and Bert, welcome to Sherlock. I forgot the name of my own show, from Sherlock. Sherlock, let's just start that again. It's been a while.
I might leave that in just for the...
Go on, yes, you must.
Outtakes on the end. Outtakes on the end.
Yeah, I'll do that again. It's all available on the red button. Scott and Bert, hello. Welcome.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, which is called Sherlock from Adler to Amberley. Not from Sherlock to Amberley, as I was about to call it just then. Thank you so much for joining us. John and I are in esteemed company here because you've done thousands of podcasts, and I think this is our 32nd in 4 years.
So, well, congratulations.
So we're always a bit nervous. One second, I'm just going to throw my dog out of the room. One second.
Oh, I think you should put the dog on. That would be.
All right, well, I'm going to let the dog whine in the background. I've no idea what he wants. Yes.
So your dog is doing something in the background as opposed to nothing in the background. That sounds very Sherlockian.
He's standing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the dog who did everything in the night while doing nothing. That's what he's doing. He's standing there whining at me for a reason I can't quite understand because he's been fed and walked. But he's like that. So I think you're on something like, is it episode 263 of your podcast? It's something like that.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. No, we are about to release. We're about to release episode 284 of iHose, and we just released episode 378 of our other Sherlock Holmes podcast, Trifles.
John, can you imagine if we worked to that sort of schedule, but bearing in mind it's taken us 4 years to get to literally get to the three students from scratch? We would have had this done a long time ago. Yeah. It's quite extraordinary. It's incredible that I love your show because it's so different to this one, i.e. it's professional. Whereas your show tends to rely on sorts of things that are happening now in the Sherlock world, and we don't do that at all. Although I love the fact you say it's always 1895 because it always is 1895.
Well, that's personally, that's why I like Three Students, because it is one of those stories that's set in 1895. But I mean, that's that 1895 hallmark. That is part of a poem written by Vincent Sterrett.
Okay.
One of the earliest Sherlockians in the United States. He lived in Chicago. He was a newspaper columnist and author, and he wrote a poem called 221B. And it's a sonnet, and it ends with, and here, though the world explode, these two survive, and it is always 1895.
Excellent.
So we kind of hang our hats on, you know, the Sherlockian movement being rooted in that time, and yet here we are in modern times talking about what's going on in Sherlock Holmes and popular culture today.
And there's an awful lot going on. Because your show is full of news, and you know this is happening here, and the safe reduction in the Valley of Fear, and things like that. So it always seems to me that when we have American guests on, that they've got so much more going on in terms of the Sherlock world than we have over here. When you thought and think it might be the opposite, but it really isn't.
Well, you might be surprised. You know, the Sherlock Holmes Society of London has a very active program, and
yeah,
Journal comes out twice a year, and there's all kinds of activities. It's just, I think, in the United States, because we are more geographically dispersed,
yeah,
there are all of these Sherlockian societies sprinkled about the country. So there's more places to put them than there are. However, I will say we are extraordinarily jealous of the home country. I mean, you have all of the sites and the places and the artifacts, and you can actually follow in Sherlock Holmes's footsteps on any given weekend if you wanted
to. We can do. I can in Norfolk. The Dancing Men is set here. Mm-hmm. And which one is it? Hudson in it. Come on, Carl. Gloria Scott. He goes to, they go to Norfolk. Mm. Where he's invited, Victor Trevor invites him to Norfolk. So there's two Norfolk stories here, and Norfolk is a good 2 hours away on by train to London. and yet we're still represented here. John, is there any Welsh stories? I think the only thing I can think of is Musgrave and, well, Rachel.
Abergavenny murder, which
is Abergavenny murder,
a lost story, you know.
Yeah, that's true as well. But yeah, we are quite represented over here. Do you know what? I'm just going to put the muzzle on the dog. Sorry, he's really annoying me. Just give me a minute. Sorry about this. He's whining. He never normally does this, but he's really bad tonight.
Oh, poor dog.
It's a regular hound of the Baskervilles.
I'll make a note to cut out this silence here.
Oh, this may be the best part.
Imagine Carl wrestling his dog right now. So.
And that's exactly what I was doing, just as you said that. Because he saw his head under the table when he saw the muzzle. Sorry, he's normally okay, but he's just not tonight. I don't know what's going on. I will start it again. That again then. So, Bert.
Yes.
So many questions. And here's the main one for me. I started reading The Count of Monte Cristo in 2012 and finished it in 2016. How did you do it before the age of 11? Are you still reading it now? Is this a continual thing?
Well, you know, that's a great idea. I should go back and reread it. I haven't read any of those since I first went through them, I don't think. Well, you know, I was growing up in we were talking earlier about you being in Norwich. I grew up in a little town in Pennsylvania, in a valley in Pennsylvania, and there was nothing else to do. So, lo and behold, I found these books on the shelf of the library, and I had seen some of the films, I think, on television, you know, not Count of Monte. Well, I may have seen the Count of Monte Cristo, but you know, these old black and white pictures would air on television, and so The Man in the Iron Mask, you know, for example, I saw some minutes of that somewhere along the line, and then when I saw the book, I said, "Oh boy!" So I just dug in.
I'm still stunned, and I was reading it. It wasn't as if I put it away and didn't bother for 2 years. I was reading it. Obviously, I was reading other things as well. But and it's fantastic. It's my friend's favourite book of all time. But when I saw that you'd read that before 11, then it started going on about Dickens as well. I thought, oh my God, he's probably done Pickwick Papers and Count of Monte Cristo in the same month.
Well, you know, there's something. It's like Sherlock Holmes in that there's something about these great stories, there's a reason why they've survived. You know, they show they've got, of course, in contemporary time, now that we've done all this literary analysis, we can reduce the story to its bare bones. But, you know, there's a hero who faces great adversity, who's unjustly accused, who's put in a terrible position. And then because of his ingenuity and his grit, he triumphs. And those are great adventure-y kinds of stories, particularly, you know, if you were a, you know, somewhat solitary kid with time on his hands.
I think we can all identify with that to some extent as well. I've actually just, we will be talking about Sherlock soon. I've actually just read Dracula for the first time at the age of 55.
What'd you think?
I can't believe I didn't read it years ago. You can see why it's so well loved. But I love the fact that Dracula's hardly in it, which is the best thing about it.
Well, do you know the Sherlockian, many Sherlockian connections there that surround Dracula, for example? I mean, there are people who've written pastiches, but you know, Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, was the business manager for Henry Irving, the actor. That's right. And Conan Doyle had his one big success in the theater was a play called, Waterloo is in the name of it. He wrote a short story called A Straggler of 15, but he turned that into a play. And Bram Stoker brought it to Henry Irving, and it became a big hit for Henry Irving. And that was on the stage the same year that Conan Doyle wrote his Brigadier Gerard stories, which are about, you know, an officer in Napoleon's army, you know, in recounting his great adventures. So there are all these kinds of connections. And one of our Sherlockian friends, Les Klinger, has published the annotated Dracula. He's sort of dug into that too.
But how like him?
Very nice, yes.
That's very like him. Yeah, I was going to email him, but I couldn't bring myself to email him to say, I've finally read it at this age, because I think he'd just be appalled at me for having left it for so long, when obviously, as Les is with every single Sherlock, I think he knows where every full stop is. He knows where every comma is. he knows absolutely everything about everything. So I couldn't quite bring myself to do it.
I'm partly appalled, but I'm also partly envious that you've got to experience it for the first time. And
yeah.
And stuff like that.
It's all, I would say the same thing about when someone says, I've never seen The Godfather. Oh, you get the restaurant now, scene for the first time.
Yeah. Now, Carl, I don't know if you know this, but they made a film of it too, you know.
All right. let me just make a note of this. Godfather. I'll look that up. Yeah, it's a little better than the book. I know you shouldn't say that. It just is, in my opinion. So we talked about, you know, how you came to The Great Detective. The question that's always the first question we ask on this podcast. The second one, and then everything else is a free-for-all, is I'm going to start with you, Scott. Do you like The Three Students?
Do I like The Three Students?
Yeah. Do you like the story?
Oh, I do. And for a few reasons. One, as I mentioned before, it's one of those iconic 1895 stories. And I think, you know, when you look at the collection of stories that is a part of the Return of Sherlock Holmes collection, yeah. There are some ripping good yarns in there. The Dancing Men, as you mentioned before, the Priory School, of course, The Empty House. You know, many of these stories, if you follow the chronologies, like in Bering Gould, were said to have taken place in 1895.
Yeah.
Black Peter, Charles Augustus Milverton, the Abbey Grange, the Second Stain. I mean, this is, to me, Holmes at the height of his powers and most iconic. And The Three Students I like because it's an academic setting. It doesn't necessarily involve a crime, although it is a transgression that has to do with honor and integrity, and those themes appeal to me. And in particular, I like this because one of the first Sherlockian groups, societies that I joined was the Speckled Band of Boston. This is one of the oldest Sherlockian groups in the United States. It was founded in 1940, one of the first local branches of the Baker Street Irregulars. And H.W. Bell, who is another early Sherlockian scholar, was the first head of the Speckled Band. And the Bell Collection and a number of other artifacts of Sherlockian interest were deposited at Houghton Library, which is the Special Collections Department, Special Collections Library at Harvard University. And included in that is the manuscript to The Three Students. So I have seen The Three Students manuscript up close. I have held it. I have touched what Conan Doyle touched himself. So to me, it's fantastic to be able to read and reread this story, knowing that there's this personal connection.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
See, John and I don't get to do this sort of thing. I've been nowhere near that sort of thing. I will come back to that, actually. But, Bert, what about you? Are you a big fan of The Three Students?
Well, I'm a big fan of Scott's answer. I think his answer is better than the story.
I like the story now, yeah. I like the story because of Scott's answer.
I don't dislike it, you know, and there are some lovely things in it. The great thing about the cases of Sherlock Holmes is that if you poke around in them or even just pay attention to the sentences, you find things. And for example, in The Three Students, you know, you have this introduction from Watson where he says, "We were residing at the time in a furnished lodgings close to the library, where Sherlock Holmes was pursuing some laborious researches in early English charters, researches which led to results so striking that they may be subject of one of my future narratives." Well, boy, I want to read that narrative more than I want to reread The Three Students. I want to know I want to know what that was all about.
Yeah.
But I enjoy the case. It's okay. It just seems to me that that the mechanics of it, you know, the crime and its detection, didn't really need to take as much effort as Sherlock Holmes puts into it. You remember, I mean, this story takes place sort of over 2 days. And what happens is on the second day, you know, Holmes is out early and he says, I turned myself out of bed at the untimely hour of 6. I've put in 2 hours of hard work and covered at least 5 miles. Well, I mean, you know, it's all about a window and a pencil, isn't it? So
that's exactly where I am with it.
So, you know, and sharpening a pencil and this, that, and the other thing. And then it all hinges on observing a glove. So, you know, I don't think it's up there with the Hound of the Baskervilles, let's say.
No, I use this term a lot. I think it's a par story. It's not a bad story because it's Sherlock Holmes and it's Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So it's not a bad story, but I think in terms of, it's never going to be, in my opinion, Bruce Partington plans Thorbridge. The ones I really think, oh, that's ingenious. No, that's really, really clever. I do like it, but it's funny you should say, like, yes, but ultimately it's about a pencil. in the same way the Case of Identity is basically about a typewriter. But that always brings me back to how far the parsley slipped into the butter. I really want to read that story too, but it's probably quite prosaic if you put it that way. But what about you, John? We don't always get to hear your opinion on the stories, but where are you at the Three Students? Did you run to your bookcase and rip it from the shelves just to have another go at it, or was it a bit of reluctance?
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with Bert and yourself on it. It's not the most gripping story, but there are, you know, good elements to it. It is very reminiscent, but just far lower stakes, of stories like Bruce Partington, Naval Treaty, Second Stain, but the stakes are just much lower. So
yeah,
with those excellent stories with high stakes, this one just feels a little bit, I don't want to use the word disappointing, but it doesn't grip you as much. So it's not as memorable.
I think you've also, I think you've got to, Scott, you mentioned, you know, the great run before this, and every single show we've done from The Empty House onwards, we've said, you know, that this is a run. This is a real proper run all the way through. And I think, I don't even mean this in a bad way, I think it begins to dip a little bit now, but only because what's come before it has just been astonishing. You know, we've just had Milverton. I'm talking in context of actually The Return, The Collection of The Return. This one, I think, drops a little bit lower, but I wonder, I mean, it's probably not because obviously they were all sort of written for the periodicals and what have you, rather than an actual collection as such. Maybe sometimes you just need to take off the really, really high-end drama things, like Milverton, you know, this incredibly successful woman, hints at royalty, that sort of thing, to the breaking of a pencil in an unnamed university town. Do you think that's it's like the porters scene in Macbeth? Sometimes you just have to draw off the big stuff again, away from the big stuff, to get to the sort of, you know, this is a puzzle, it's not of high, as John says, it's not of high state importance.
Yeah, and I think it's also, you know, we're used to seeing Holmes and Watson in their typical confines at the flat at 221B Baker Street. The cozy chairs in front of the fireplace, and a problem comes, a client enters, and they're presented with it. This is, to your point, it's not a crime, right? And I think that the interest is twofold. It's a puzzle, right? So that already sets it on a different level. But this is also Sherlock Holmes on location. So yeah, it's a field trip of sorts. It doesn't even begin in Baker Street, and then they set out by train and stay over somewhere. This actually is Sherlock Holmes let's just call it like it is. Sherlock Holmes in Oxford. This is a kind of a specialty story, as it were. So it does set itself apart for that reason. You know, I should also say one of the reasons I also do like this story is because I'm convinced that my favorite apothecary was named after two characters here, and that's Gilchrist and Soames.
Oh, wow. I don't care if that's not true. it is in my mind. Oh, I like that. In some ways, I think I prefer the, well, prefer is a bit too strong a term, but I really enjoy the puzzle ones. And, you know, it's just, oh, it's this, oh, and, you know, rather than people charging through the night. I mean, I love the Red-Headed League and anything that involves a stakeout, of which there are plenty, I really like. But I like the element of the three candidates in this as well, because it immediately calls upon your own prejudice. And my God, Watson's guilty of that too. Well, Watson says, it's got to be the man because he's rude. So therefore he must be the criminal, too strong a word, but, you know, he must be the cheat, which I think is quite ingenious. I really like the idea of Conan Doyle basically saying to the reader, there they are. I know which one you're going to go for, and you're going to be wrong. That's really nice.
Yeah, I think Holmes himself in here at some point says quite the three-card trick.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And that's it. I mean, you know, it has to be one of the three. So who's your choice? And Watson takes his choice. And I think Soames has his choice. And lo and behold, it's the golden child. It's
the nice man.
Right. The one you would have least expected.
Yeah, because he's so polite and nice. And it's great. I love you say that Soames makes a choice. And of course he does make a choice. But I love the way he denies it so vehemently. I would not to go far as to say that. You've absolutely thrown one of them under a bus and said, look, it's probably him because he's been gambling a lot, which is quite strange. But I don't get, it's interesting you say that, Scott, about, you know, where, you, I'm not sure what you, Scott, I think it might have been birth. Actually, it's not a two-day problem, this. that's one of my only problems with it. I think straight away when he finds out one of them's a long jumper and it's obvious what the play is, then a long jumper's been in this room. Now let's go back to our rooms again and just leave Soames didn't sleep. Mm. I don't quite understand that.
Is that him being theatrical though and having a big reveal?
Well, he does like that, doesn't he?
He likes a bit of drama. He likes keeping everyone on edge and keeping them waiting and stuff like that. Is that just him building up the suspense about something he's actually solved in like 2.5 minutes?
I think it is just because he has, in the actual chronological order, he hasn't actually done it yet, but Abbey Grange, he ends with a court case. And he pretty much does the same here. He says, you know, I'm not going to tell anyone about this. Go away. You know, it's, you know, you to where is human. Off you go. He does love a bit of a courtroom. And I think he's enjoying himself so much. And maybe he's not quite getting on with English charters as much as he was thinking, well, this is OK. I think he solves it in 5 minutes. I really do.
I think you're right. But here's my take on it. I think I agree with you. He solved it almost immediately. And he certainly could have sprung it on the tutor that, yes, I've found your man. I know who it is. It is Gilchrist. However, I think what Holmes does is by going through this methodically, first of all, he takes Watson along on the journey. So Watson has just as much information as Holmes does. It allows Holmes to go and confront the students. And it also puts Bannister on warning as well. And what does Bannister do? We find out he went to Gilchrist and counseled him as his late father would have. So that the next morning, Holmes doesn't reveal who it is. Gilchrist comes in and makes a full confession, right, and comes clean. And I think that was Holmes kind of deferring to what was left of his honor, that giving him a chance to save himself, throw himself on the mercy of the court rather than just throwing him to the lions, so to speak.
Yeah. It's very interesting, the role of Bannister, because again, Holmes says straight away, the second he sees that he's had to cross a fair few acres of carpet to sit down, and Holmes points that out straight away, why didn't he just go there? And, oh, yeah, because I fainted. I don't know what I was doing. Really? Okay. And Conan Doyle deliberately leaves that there as if to say, well, he's not happy with that explanation, is he? So I think he does know about it straight away. Of course, the only thing he can't guess is the relationship between Bannister and Gilchrist Senior. So Jabez is a great name. I really like that name. He's got some great names in this. He really has. We mentioned Watson on this show. The only side issue we do, if we don't really do agendas as such, but we do have a section called Watson Watch. It's never doesn't go on for much too long, to be honest, because what does Watson do in this story, Bert? Does he have any significance other than just record? Bearing in mind Musgrave ritual, he sits in a chair and listens.
Well, you know, you've got Holmes talking to Watson in occasionally a very deprecating way. He says, oh, this is not one of your cases, Watson. It's mental, not physical. Oh, yeah, all right, come if you want to.
Surprised me when I read that line. I thought, oh, that's too biting.
Yeah, that's pretty grumpy. But Watson does things. I mean, he tells us, you know, he says he sets the scene well. He doesn't do anything really in the case, but no. He says, you know, Holmes basically is not in very good spirits because he doesn't have the congenial surroundings of Baker Street. Without his scrapbooks, his chemicals, and homely untidiness, he was an uncomfortable man. So, you know, that's good value for him to and eventually Holmes will say, Watson, I have always done you an injustice. So, you know, it all works out in the end.
He says, I've done you an injustice. There are others. Is he basically saying, I thought it was just you who was a bit thick. But no, there are other people. Because that's how I read that. He says, yeah, oh, God, you're all like this. And obviously the BBC version, they do it. Oh, my God, what it must be like to live in your mind. You know, it's so empty. And if that is the case, and I think it is, well done, Watson, for getting it down, because that's an absolute brutal line.
Yeah,
I've never done you justice. There are others just like you.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's part of Holmes's sense of humor coming through here, because you've got this line, Watson, I've always done you an injustice. And then, of course, the evening before the case is solved, he says, by Jove, my dear fellow, it's nearly 9. And the landlady babbled of green peas at 7:30, which is a great line, by the way.
Yeah.
And he says, what with your eternal tobacco, Watson, and your irregularity at meals, I expect you will get notice to quit and that I shall share your downfall. And of course, he's referring to himself and his own habits there, but he's putting it on Watson to just kind of give him a little ribbing.
Yeah, and it's a moment of great awareness, self-awareness as well. So this must really irritate you. So I'm going to throw it back at you. Scott, you brought up, I think there is one huge mystery in the three students, and I believe it's probably spoken more about than the pencil or what Dalat Ras is doing stomping around in his room. Where are they? Which city are they in? And you've said it, and if dear old Nick Utekin was here, he'd be shaking your hand for saying this.
Yes.
You're convinced he's Oxford.
Great Oxonian, Nick was. And of course, he wrote a treatise on this, Sherlock Holmes at Oxford.
Yep.
And I think this goes all the way back to T.S. Blakeney from the 1940s, I think, from his Sherlock Holmes Factor Fiction. We have an analysis that... you know, because Holmes was doing the research into the early English charters, and in 1895, according to Blakeney, that would be the place at which to do it. You wouldn't have had the same resources at Cambridge at the time. So I think there are a lot of reasons that it comes down to Oxford. But that certainly, that opening certainly gives us the greatest hint.
Are you convinced by that, Bert?
Well, I'm always in Nick's camp, so I'm happy to focus on Oxford. The thing that always bothered me about all this is this is so painful a scandal. You know, Watson describes this early on. I really can't. I mean, life must be pretty even at an unusually even keel at university if this is as big a deal as it sounds. But then, of course, it's the early 20th century and it was cheating. And, there is that moral dimension. But I find it hard to believe that and the peculiarity of this, you know, we're not even talking about writing down what's on the paper, you know, which itself was bizarre. But, I find it hard to believe that this would have shaken the foundations of a great university. But that's just me.
Well,
and Simon is absolutely apoplectic about this.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
It's not just a minor scandal. He's talking about his own reputation being damaged. And, you know, yeah, it's evident.
Remember, this is a scholarship that is at stake.
Yes.
Taking any random exam. So, and I should note too, in one of the annotated versions, Christopher Morley, who was a Rhodes Scholar, he and his three brothers, Christopher Morley, of course, founded the Baker Street Irregulars, yep. And his brothers Frank and Felix were also Rhodes Scholars along with him. So he knows a thing or two about Oxford. Morley agreed with T.S. Blakeney that this is, in fact, where the story takes place, because he says, my own theory is that he was at Oxford consulting the excellent Stubbs, Bishop of Oxford and Regius Professor of History, who was in that year preparing his 8th edition of the Select Charters, a classic among historical students.
Okay.
Boy, you know, glad you mentioned that, because I only have the 7th edition. I'll have to go over to ABE Books and see what I can find.
Call yourself a historical scholar. Yeah.
It's always a delight to mention Nick. We were only lucky enough to have him on one show, which is Gloria Scott. And I asked him which university town the story begins with when he first meets Victor Trevor and Cerberus fixes himself onto his ankle. I said, which one is it then, Nick? And he said, well, Carl, I'm the author of Sherlock Holmes in Oxford. All right, okay.
That's great.
So that was just lovely. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. That was a great episode to have.
I would like to point out that it's clear, at least to me, that Gilchrist was not adept at cheating. This was not his normal approach to things, because if he were, or if he were smart about it, he would have simply written down the first line and then the last line of the charter, and then figured out, you know, gone to his own text and figured out exactly which chapter of Thucydides it came from and studied that, rather than sitting there laboriously copying the entire document.
And not just standing there, Scott, pretty much standing in the window in a star jump position so everyone can see him do it.
Exactly.
It's extraordinary. I mean, the only, it's not a problem, but I always refer to the BBC Radio 4 adaptations of this. And this one is great because the man who plays Soames actually wrote the adaptation for it, which was quite rare, I think, in radio. And in the BBC version, the radio version, it shows them going to the rooms individually. So, you know, Ras has lines and, you know, McLaren shouts from the other side of the door. You know, I've
frozen on the stool. Why be you?
Yeah. So, who are you? Why are you? In particular, why are you? Which is just lovely. And when I reread it again for this, I thought, oh, well, that's right. That's just the BBC version. They didn't put... So Dalek Ras is wonderfully rude as well, but obviously, but he lets him, you know, into the rooms to get his pencil checked, as it were. it's all about the pencil. There isn't too much more to talk about the three students. I like it. I like it, but I think it suffers from where it falls within the return. And I think it marks, I'm not a big fan of the Missing Three Quarter or Golden Pond Snake. I think they're okay, but I think I've got it in for the three students a little bit just because it's not Solitary Cyclist, Dance and Men, Milverton, Black Peter, Priory School. I think that's not its fault, because sometimes I think you just need a decent story rather than a classic. I think that's where I am with it. Mm. What about you, John? We haven't heard from you much.
It's not a bad story. I think it just suffers from where it appears. If this was in, you know, the Adventures, it would be a fantastic story. But, you know, we've got the bias of where it appears in the canon. Like you said, you know, if you're sitting down reading, you know, the collected thing. And we said earlier, Carl, about how, you know, it might be different if you're reading it, you know, week by week in the periodical. I'm not sure it would, because I think, you know, you might have a bit of anticlimax even there, you know, coming after Milverton, you know, or I can't wait till next week, and then, or however often they were published. And yeah.
I hope it's about a pencil. I can't wait. I hope there's a scratch on the, desk somewhere. What do you think of Plymouth, by the way?
You know, we did an entire Trifles episode about pencils. You might like to look into that one.
Oh, now we're talking. I mentioned this more than once, but we did The Crooked Man with our friend Trevor Bond, and we decided that the only crime that Henry Wood commits is importing a mongoose across Asia. When I'm talking detail, he had the paperwork. Trevor brought the paperwork in with him to discuss. If he'd gone through Afghanistan, it might have been a bit easier for him. But the second bit, and that discussion went on for quite some time.
I think that discussion was about 40 minutes. I don't think we discussed the story, just the mongoose.
Yeah, yeah. I think we mentioned the murder at the end. Well, it's not even a murder, is it? No, it's cardiac arrest, I think. Heart failure, that was it. Trifle sounds very, very monstrous, to be honest. Like that. But if you ever need a mongoose man, Trevor Bond is your man, if you want to bring him in. He doesn't get many phone calls, I've got to say that. Gents, thank you so much for doing this. You really, really appreciate it. It's great to have you on. What's coming up next then from I Hear a Sherlock?
Well, we actually are about to publish, as I said, episode 284. That is a conversation with the gents over at the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes podcast.
Okay. It's
our second conversation with them. The reason we had them back on is because in late May, over on your side of the pond in Guildford, they are hosting BrettCon to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Granada Sherlock Holmes series.
Which features my school very briefly.
All right.
In the, what would it be? Scandal of Bohemia? Is it Scandal of Bohemia? Red Header League, where they go to the opera after he's examined John Clay's trousers. And he sits in the auditorium, and that's my school. And it was filmed while I was at the school, and no one knew about it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they filmed it on a Sunday, and they show him walking past the bank, and my school looked a bit like a bank. It's like it's the Liverpool Institute, and where you know, two of the Beatles went, so it's quite a famous building in Liverpool. And they must have done it on a Sunday, because no one knew about it at all. It wasn't even mentioned at all. So I'm quite tempted by that, to go to that as well. And what are you doing next on Trifles? Please say mongooses. It is mongooses, not mongoose. Trevor told us that.
Have we done mongoose yet, Bert?
That's we should tell them we are planning on revealing, you know, an important new dimension to the case of Corporal Henry Wood, because we've discovered through researches into Old English charters that in actuality, the mongoose was really a ferret in a mongoose suit.
No, it was two ferrets in a trench coat.
With a hat.
No, we did discuss mongoose on episode 220.
What's the plural of mongoose? Is that mongoose?
It is mongooses. Yeah, Trevor.
Ferrets. Yeah.
Basic ferrets. Yeah. Yeah, definitely mongooses. Trevor was very, very forceful in making that point. Clearly something, a subject close to his heart.
Are multiple ferrets a Ferrari? Is that?
Well, it is now.
Lamborghini.
Should be.
Yeah. I like that. This is where we're going to, I like the idea that every single Sherlock podcast eventually is going to have to do a mongoose episode. Because this is going to be two of them now. This is fantastic. Well, gents, thank you so much for coming on. Bert, good luck with the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yes, thank you. You too.
I'll speak to you again in 4 years. There you go. Well, that's brilliant. We hope to have you on again. The next one we're doing, what is the next one we're doing, John?
Pincenez, isn't it? Pontenez.
Pontenez, yeah.
However you pronounce those words, I'm Welsh.
Exactly, yeah. Heathborough. Wyndham. The little spectacles one.
Okay. Yeah,
and I think that's Catherine, isn't it? I think Catherine's coming back to do that. It is Catherine, yeah, Catherine's doing that. Yes, we've got the Golden Pontenez, followed by Mission Three Quarter, Abbey Grange, which I love, and then Bonnie's going to do the second stain, and then it gets into his last bow. But brilliant. Sorry, that's just show admin. I've just done it on there. Thank you very much again for coming on, and hopefully we will be talking to you soon.
Grand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to thank our hosts at Rippercast, as well as producers Jonathan Mengus and John Rees. A special thank you too to Andrew Firth, who created both the graphics and the theme music. You can contact us on Twitter at Adler to Amberley. Thank you for listening.